Hi, and welcome to the first episode of The Operators, where we learn about the people building the companies of tomorrow. We publish every other Monday, and you can find us online at operators.co. Today's episode is sponsored by Four Sigmatic. Four Sigmatic's Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee has all of coffee's focusing bark with none of the jittery bite. Lion's Mane promotes productivity, focus, and creativity, all while being a healthy alternative to that daily cup of coffee. Go to foursigmatic.com/operatorsspecial to try out Four Sigmatic. I'm your host, Neil Devani, and we're coming to you today from Digital Garage here in sunny San Francisco. Joining me is Russ Heddleston, founder and CEO of DocSend, a fast-rising tool to send and share sensitive documents. Also joining us is Whitney Sales, a partner at Acceleprise, the premier SaaS accelerator. Whitney has 10 years of startup sales experience and is the founder of The Sales Method, a consultancy that helps startups with go-to-market and sales. Whitney and Russ, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. If we could start, if you could just give us a little bit of your background, that'd be great.
Sure. I'll get started. Sure. Russ Heddleston, as you said, co-founder and CEO at DocSend. My background is not in sales. It's in software engineering. So I was at Stanford for a bachelor's and master's in computer science. And then I've worked at a bunch of different tech companies over the years as an intern at Microsoft, as a PM intern, as the first engineering intern at Trulia. I ran the engineering team at a company called Graystripe for a few years. Early intern at Dropbox. And then DocSend's actually my second company. Started the first one in 2010 while I was in business school out at Harvard, and then ended up being acquired by Facebook. And then I started DocSend about 6 years ago here in San Francisco.
Awesome.
And my name is Whitney Sales. I am a GP, so general partner at Acceleprise Ventures, and my background is in early stage sales. So before Acceleprise, I actually ran a startup sales consultancy called The Sales Method, where I worked with founders in getting to $1 million in ARR. So really in the early stages of the problem solving of sales. And before that, I worked for several startups. LoopNet in the early days helped launch two products for them. I worked at a company called Meltwater before they were acquired. Worked for a company called Spring Ahead, now Tally, they were also acquired. Ran sales for a company called People Data Labs. And then just spun out on my own and started The Sales Method, which ended up bringing me into Acceleprise.
Awesome. What a great story. So just to start, I would love to hear from both of you a little bit about your organizations and how you think about sales. And maybe if you can give us a little bit of the definitions around the different roles that you see in a sales organization, whether it's your company or in the companies you're investing in or have worked with in the past.
Great. So there's a lot of different roles in sales. It really depends on the type of organization you're running, candidly. But traditionally, there's an SDR, so a sales development rep. I usually recommend that being the first hire on a sales team for a founder so they can help scale up their own time. Then there's an account executive within an organization. They're typically doing the direct sales. There may be senior account executives or junior account executives, like a mid-market and an enterprise executive, depending on the type of sales cycle they're running. Sales engineers, if you're dealing with a complex dev tool traditionally, or a more heavy enterprise implementation tool. And then if you look at customer support and customer success, those kind of roles and being part of sales. SDRs traditionally will fall under the demand generation, and it can fit under sales, it can fit under marketing, so that's a little bit of a debate in the ecosystem on where they sit, but that's generally how I see the teams breaking down from a team perspective.
Cool. And do you guys structure yourselves at DocSend that way? Do you have these different roles like that?
Yeah, we definitely break it out. I also think even more fundamental than how you structure your sales team is what is your business go-to-market model. And so the way you do early sales is very different if you're saying, we're targeting 500K a year contracts and we're doing top-down from very senior in the organization versus something that's more land and expand or even freemium or kind of a lower cost model of acquisition. And different products and different value propositions lend themselves to each of them. So for DocSend, we've got about 9,000 companies that are paying for it. And what's worked really well for us has been the product spreads itself pretty well. There are a few different price points. We'll get into a company. And then the sales team, we have just two different functions, SDR and AE. And SDRs are booking meetings when people are interested. They're also looking at the data, seeing when a certain team is expanding their number of seats on DocSend. They'll reach out, add value, make sure they know how it works, and they'll set up a call for an AE to try to get them upsold or make sure they're getting the most out of it, or even just introduce them directly to the customer success team we have that's all post-sales, or they're just going to help out with accounts that are end up paying enough money for DocSend that we need someone in there to help manage them. And we also have, obviously, a VP of sales, and he'll get more involved when, you know, a large enterprise comes inbound with interest and says, I want a demo. Then he's very helpful for running that because it looks very, very different. One, if it's inbound versus outbound, and two, if it's a big enterprise versus, you know, a smaller company.
Makes sense. When you guys think about the folks that you've hired or worked with, what kind of backgrounds do you see coming in? What makes someone, you know, good at sales?
Oh my gosh, I think we both just looked at each other and that's a tough question.
It plays a lot to what you're talking about, depending on the model, the mm-hmm. sales model. So you broke down different types. I look at three traditional sales models. There's the enterprise model, which are heavy enterprise customers, longer sales cycles. There's mm-hmm. the mid-market model, which is more of traditionally an inside sales model. And there's, you know, the premium land and expand SMB. So it's almost a more consumer type model. So the type of person for those roles really varies quite a bit. So for your land and expand, it's more transactional, your more freemium models and lower price points, it's more transactional salesperson. So you're looking for people who typically more junior, faster sales cycles, want to get quick wins a lot, typically less sales experience. Your mid-market and inside sales people are traditionally have some sales experience, maybe have moved from an SDR role before. And then you have your enterprise people, they typically have done sales for a while, have a network that they're bringing to the table, more relationship oriented, because they're having to work with those customers for a long period of time, and ideally starting, you know, on an enterprise deal and then expanding across the, starting with a fin and then going after the entire whale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the DNA of those really matters, but then it's also the type of organization you are. But I'll let you talk to a little bit more around
that. No, I think that's actually really good. Your baseline to cover it at, because it does depend on a lot of factors, as well as just the amount of experience you have. And certain people can actually go up faster through the ranks, and some mm-hmm. people kind of get stuck even at SDR or mm-hmm. SMBAE. And so the skill set does change between them. Some people will specialize in one. Other people really like moving between them over time and can actually then be pretty flexible sales leaders, because the team that you manage as a sales leader is also really different and kind of mm-hmm. depends on your background there. There are also some other interesting areas like media sales. Like a lot of our customers are in media sales, and that's actually just an entirely separate type of thing than SaaS sales. So when we look at salespeople, like if they have media sales experience, I'm usually like, a little different, or like services are also very different. And so when we think about sales in the Silicon Valley sense, we're usually talking about SaaS sales, but there are just so many other different types of sales. Insurance sales is huge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I always try to think about it in the most general sense for sales, but thinking specifically about SaaS, I do think that you can start out as an SDR, and it's just really how fast can you learn? Because I think most organizations are willing to promote people as they develop the skills, mm-hmm. and it is increasingly hard to find people who are at that mid-market level, which becomes much more about an account-based sale. If you just do the best practices from an SMB AE perspective for a mid-market deal, you will definitely fail. So there are certain concepts that you need to be introduced to and then get really good at. And it really is a craft. It takes a long time, and it's a pretty big knowledge base that you have to adopt to be really good at the job.
Another point to mention as well is the stage of a company's evolution actually plays a lot in the DNA of the salesperson you're hiring. So your initial hires that you're going to bring onto the team are traditionally people who are more generalist. So they can take on a little bit of support, maybe a little bit of the SDR function. They might be handled in the entire sales cycle. But as the company evolves, the specialization of those people from an SDR, an AE, an enterprise capacity really evolves with the organization. So you really have to look at that in the DNA when you're hiring people, or at the type of organization you're going into and the stage they're at as well.
Yeah, it's great advice. If I'm someone who is, let's say I'm coming from a background of being an engineer, or I'm working in retail as a barista, or like a manager in a retail store, or even if I'm in school, you know, and I have like 6 months till graduation, and I know from where I am today, I want to try and have a job at a good company doing sales, maybe as an SDR as a starting point. What would be the advice you would give someone like that to start making that transition, or be prepared to start going out for interviews and to do well?
Do you want to take that one?
Sure, I can start on that one. So there are different trade-offs. If you are, you know, in a non-sales role today and you want to get into sales, if you're looking at a more mature sales organization, they are going to be very structured and they're going to have, you know, more set criteria, even to get onto their SDR team. So it also depends on where you kind of are in your career and if you're career switching into it versus you're just in school. They usually do a very good job of onboarding and training. And so going into that interview, just doing practice interviews, networking, people already been through the interviews, meeting people on that sales team. You want to be very aware of the sales culture the company has as well as like the promotion path within it. If you want to get more involved in the startup scene, which is actually really fun, there's definitely a larger element of risk to that. One of the nice things about going to work at an early stage startup in sales is that nobody has it figured out yet. So they really need help and creativity, and they need someone who's going to work really hard and just help them figure it out. And let's just say you're an engineer, like my background in engineering. Engineers actually make very good salespeople because they are about process. They're about listening. They're about solving problems. There might be some skills gaps, like in the traditional stereotypical engineering sense. Maybe you need to work on your presence or rapport building or, you know, being charismatic at the right point in the right time, but engineers actually make very, very good salespeople. If you've been a barista for a while, you might be really good at rolling with the punches and might just need to, but even then, like you're also already very process oriented in terms of like what you're spending your time on. So I think it's just translating those skills and then being aware of some of the gaps you might have. And if you're going to pitch a startup about being one of their first sales hires, be empathetic towards what the company needs and ask a lot of questions about that. And you're really just convincing them to take a bet on you that you're going to help them figure it out.
Yeah. I really liked your point that engineers actually make great salespeople. It's one of the things, because I work with a lot of founders and they think they're not going to be good at it or that someone else is going to be better at the job. I'm like, no. Engineers are amazing salespeople. My first boss I ever had at LoopNet was an engineer by training. Awesome. He's amazing. He scaled the team from 4 to 120 people and IPO. So he's awesome. So I guess the advice I would give someone who's looking to go into sales, because I personally never thought I was going to end up in sales. I thought I was going to be a lawyer and then hated law. And my first boss I had in college actually recommended I go into sales. And I was like, if I didn't know you like me, I think it was an insult. Because it's not a profession you think you're going to be a lawyer going into sales.
Let's talk about that for a second, actually. We should come back to, you know, what makes, how to get into sales. But I think sales does have this stigma around it, where it's like, oh, you couldn't do another job, so you're doing sales. Mm-hmm. And there's no, I keep hearing from other folks, there's no higher education for sales. There's no organized education for sales. There's these training programs. There's companies like Flockjay now. But otherwise, why do you think that is? Why is it? Because from what I know, you can do very well for yourself, especially if you're in enterprise software and doing sales. But it still has this...
Some opinions about that one.
I would love to hear that.
I'll let you go first.
It really bothers me that there's no entrepreneurial, there's five entrepreneurial sales courses in every MBA, in the MBA programs across the country. It really bothers me. So you graduate with a Harvard MBA and you learn sales management, but you don't actually learn how to sell. So some of my clients, when I was consulting on a regular basis, were MBA students. I was teaching them how to sell. They're founders and they're like, I graduated with an MBA and I never got this skill set. This is crazy. And I think a lot of it has to do with sales was seen as an art form before. It was a people skill. And I think as it's become a larger profession, this you know, my opinion, you might have different opinions on it, but I think as it's become more of a process and it's been dissected, like there's lots of different things around it, but people are starting to teach it more as a science and a process. And in the early days of selling as a founder, it really is a process. It's like building its own product. It's the script that you design for each individual customer in the same way you're building out a product and features for individual customer bases. And so part of it, I think, has to do with the reputation behind it. It was also seen as something that was distrustful in the days, and I think a lot of it has to do with media, too, candidly. It's seen as kind of this low-level, uneducated profession, but in reality, like, it's actually a very hard job, and there is this really strong science behind it. So, I don't
know. You know, those are actually great thoughts. I agree with all of them. It's also that coming back to the notion that there are a lot of different types of sales. If you're in car sales, it's just very different than if you're an investment banker, who I totally consider to be in sales. So, mm-hmm. what's interesting across StockSend's customer base is that the way the product works is much, it's pretty geared towards deal making and insights around who's reading what and where they're sending them. And so because of the model we have, we get to see all the different types of companies that use that product, but it's also made me realize how many people are in sales but would never self-identify as being in sales. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a GP, for instance, closing a fund, mm-hmm. you're in sales. Mm-hmm. You know, you are running around getting checks from people to fill out your fund. Mm-hmm. And there are just a lot of jobs that are like that. And so mm-hmm. I do think the skill set is something that is much more applicable than the stereotype for it. And it is also something that there's not a lot of curriculum behind. Mm-hmm. And then I also think that software sales is very different from other types of traditional sales. Yeah. And as software becomes more complicated, a lot of engineers would like to think that that will just get rid of the need for sales, or they have some future vision of the world where they're, oh, why do we need salespeople? A lot of technical founders I've talked to have this view. And in fact, the complexity of the software world means that the role of sales is even more important, and it becomes more difficult to help companies navigate these decisions and to make themselves more efficient. So I do think there's a bit of a disconnect between what sales is today, what it was historically, and how it's portrayed in the media, and even who is or isn't in sales. So I do think it's something worth investing in and learning a lot about. Definitely tell our own sales team that these are life skills you're learning, mm-hmm. and they're going to be applicable no matter where you go after this, even if you don't have a full career in sales.
Yeah, I think so it's really interesting. They are very universal skills, regardless of what you're doing. Your job almost always involves some amount of persuasion, right, and some amount of communication, even if you're not in sales. And so I can't remember who says this, but someone always likes to say, like, everything is sales, regardless of what you're doing. And the point you made about fundraising is sales, recruiting is sales, mm-hmm. Management is sales, and then, of course, sales is sales.
Yeah, even changing your product you're having to sell to internally in your team, any type of, like, interactions amongst your team where you're trying to get an idea through is sales. It touches mm-hmm. every part of what you're doing.
Yeah, it is interesting. You both mentioned, you know, engineers getting into sales, and I was giving you some other examples of folks. There aren't, from what I understand, and correct me if you disagree, any requirements from an education perspective to get into sales. It's very hard to do and to get really good at, but it's not required that you have some degree or background education. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It depends on the company. Some companies put in requirements, but I don't think there are inherently any requirements to be in sales and be great mm-hmm. at it.
Sales is very much a competency versus skill set.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes it unique compared to some other roles, or at least mm-hmm. how we view those roles today.
Yeah. Although engineering itself is a little bit similar in the sense that you can be a college dropout and an amazing engineer.
That's
and
true.
All we care about is that you're an amazing engineer.
Yeah,
you can
true,
be a
yeah.
college dropout and a great salesperson, and it becomes relatively self-evident quickly as you dig through, you know, how good they are at their particular type of sales, or even their just desire to be great at it. You don't particularly care about their other credentials.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's change gears a little bit. Let's talk about your previous experiences, your experiences as well, in thinking about someone who's starting a company, who's a founder. And is having to do sales for the first time, and then we'll get into, you know, hiring sales for the first time. But what kind of advice would you have, and what kind of experiences have you had having to sell the product yourself without having a long history or experience in sales?
Yeah, I put myself through my own boot camp. I would definitely recommend working with other people who know more about this. Don't try to learn it all on your own if you're a founder. There are a lot of people out there like Whitney who have been thinking about this forever and can help accelerate your learning around it. For StockSend, we didn't charge anything for the first 2 years. Like, you couldn't even pay us for the product. We were just in beta, testing it out, like making sure people liked it, really iterating on product market fit. In retrospect, I would have charged more. I would have charged earlier, and I also would have gotten out there and just tried to sell it more to people earlier. So the earlier you can do that, the better. And a lot of times founders
would you have done that because it would have made it easier to sell and people to use, or because there was some other value in doing that?
I would say that like Whitney said, it's basically a separate development track. It is, if you're building a product, it makes sense you have to build the product, and then people think, well, once I build the product, then I can sell the product. In fact, you can start selling the product before you have a product at all.
Right, right.
There's the kind of the concept of MVP, minimum viable product. There's also the concept of MVPPT, the minimum viable PowerPoint. So you don't have to have the thing before you can start to get feedback. And there's a concept of product market fit, but there's a separate concept of message market fit. Mm-hmm. And you can only discover message market fit by getting out there and talking to people. And if you get someone like really engaged and they just really have this problem and you can help solve it for them, you can discover a lot about, is this an SMB thing? Is this a mid-market thing? Is this more of an enterprise thing? So it can actually help shape your entire go-to-market strategy by just getting out there in the field and having conversations. And, you know, there's nothing else that can substitute for that.
What was the first time you felt you had message market fit, and how is it different from the times before where you weren't getting it?
For us, it's a little bit different simply because of the go-to-market model of, and just how the product has spread. So a lot of times what's happened has been we'll interview people who are already customers and figure out why they like it so much. Mm-hmm. And then we'll use that messaging for new people that sign up. And so then we can repeat back to them why someone else likes it so much in language that makes sense to them. And so what we found is that as we've done that in different use cases for our technology, the conversion goes up significantly. And what that just speaks to is there are early adopters for something. Like if you build a great technology, yeah, some people are going to buy it. But if you're going to try to scale it, like you really have to view your messaging as something entirely separate from your product that you have to get right. And sales both can accelerate your growth and also accelerate your learning around who your audience is and how do you get more of them.
You actually alluded to something that I actually teach on a regular basis for early stage founders, which is ask your customers how they would describe the product to someone else and in your target market. So it's something I teach all the time in positioning. So I love that. That I was like, oh, got a little smile on the face, my face for that. So for early stage founders, the first thing I like to make sure that's framed is sales is two things. It's problem solving and project management. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of nuances to it, but if you can solve the customer's problem, they're usually going to listen. And then the project management piece is getting it through the buying process within the organization. And so it kind of, if you can simplify it down to those two things, you get rid of a lot of the emotional hang-ups that people have around sales. And so that's the first piece I usually work with founders on is what emotional junk do they have around the concept of selling? Because some people come across as salesy, but in reality, as a founder, people are buying from you. People are always buying from people. And so the more authentic you can be in those interactions, the better. And so if you can get rid of the emotional junk, usually the person can actually show up to have a conversation. And then there's there's five core steps that I look at in go to market. The first one is identifying what's your target market, so your beachhead market that has four things. Pain, so they have the pain point you solve for, access, so you can actually get in front of those people, and then money, so they actually have the money to spend, so you're talking to those people within the organizations and those types of organizations. And then you're looking for the buyers and then the actual targets. And then I go into positioning. So using those questions like, using the question like Russ mentioned around how would you describe your product to someone else to get your overall brand positioning for your specific target market, and then how they actually describe the benefits of that product for people. So that gives you your benefit statements to actually sell into them. And then channels. So how do your buyers actually learn about new products? So getting in front of them in the ways they buy. And then finally, your pricing and BD, because your who you partner with really needs to align with how you price your product. So those are kind of the first pieces I talk about with founders on a regular basis.
That's a lot of stuff to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. One other thing I throw out there is a concept that's really important to identify early on if you're a founder trying to go do your own sales is if it's a transactional thing or not, or if you've gotten someone interested. One of the things I learned was that you have to be very upfront about questions like, what is your process for buying software? Mm-hmm. Or who else needs to buy in for this decision to happen? Like, they're just questions that are less about convincing the person in front of you that this is a problem you can help them solve, and more about like what's this person's role in the organization and how does this work out. Like there was like one person we sold at a big media company, and then asked too late, like, oh, so how does like budgeting work for you guys? She's like, oh my gosh. She described their business as like Gringotts. She's like, I'm sure there's money somewhere, but I'm going to have to go dig around for it for you.
There's so, probably a goblin somewhere that's guarding it.
That was my mental image for it. Yeah.
Big tip. How much can people put on their credit cards without having to get sign off?
Yeah.
Big tip on selling. Yep.
Other questions around like contract length too. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's anything over a year needs to go through legal. And so you might actually just want to have it be a 6-month contract. So you just mm-hmm. don't go through legal. If you don't have to go through legal, please find a way to avoid that. You know,
it'll this just is a recurring a theme. Avoid lawyers in law school.
Lawyers and CFOs.
So when we're thinking about, founders doing sales, that's an interesting question to me in terms of should the founder or a founder be the one selling. Philosophically, I always think like if you're a founder, at least one of the founders needs to be doing the selling to be hands-on with customers in early days. How do you guys feel about that? What are your beliefs around that?
I'm a very strong believer that one member of the founding team needs to be selling. One, it's a core competency that a founding team needs to have because of all the things we mentioned earlier, like hiring, fundraising, mm-hmm. acquiring your first customers, navigating like networking, things like that, that are really important that sales skills are required for. And then two, it's a core competency of a successful business. It's the revenue side of a business, and that needs to be owned by someone who's on the founding team in the business. So I'm pretty strong in believing that you need to have a founding member of the team selling. It doesn't necessarily need to be, the C-suite. It could be a VP of sales that's on the founding team or a CRO type person or operating person to start, but I'm a pretty strong believer on it.
Likewise. The ordering for me was when we started DocSend, I was working with two co-founders. We're all sitting around coding the product, and then we had to go raise money, or I decided that it was time to go raise money because we had enough positive feedback, like, this is good. I also did a lot of customer interviews, so I've mostly been a product manager, like I was a PM at Facebook, and so I've done a lot of customer interviews. There's a lot of overlap, actually, between mm-hmm. those and sales in terms of some of the process. They're very different, but I was already very comfortable with that. So I've been doing all these product interviews. We went out and raised a seed round of funding from Uncork, and then after that, we could hire engineers. And so I was the person who was in the sales seat, just figuring out like, who do we sell to? How do we sell to them? But yeah, it is, I agree that someone on the founding team needs to wear that hat. And even if no one is a career VP of sales, even if no one's worked in sales on the team, someone's going to have to go figure it out. And you don't have to be the greatest in the world at it. You just need to learn enough so that you can go off and hire other people to do it. There's another concept I like where any business that requires phenomenal salespeople is going to be tough to scale. So if you are a founder and you're like, I'm not that great at sales, just remember, like, your product needs to get to a state and your messaging needs to get to a state where it's not like rocket science to sell it to somebody mm-hmm. out there. So picking your target industry, target personas, verticals, like all that stuff, and iterating on it and just building up your own sense of what makes a lot of sense. And then you can go hire some people to do it for you.
Yep.
So that's a great segue to the next question, which is like, at what point are you ready to hire someone? When do you feel like it's a good time to bring on more people? How do you go about doing that?
Lots and lots of opinions on this one. Also depends on if you're just doing enterprise sales or not. Like, your first salesperson could be a field rep, mm-hmm. Or your first salesperson could be a BDR. And I do think, and Whitney, you alluded to this earlier, where mm-hmm. for many companies, the first hire needs to be a BDR just to take time off the founder's plate. Mm-hmm. So you can find someone either to answer inbounds or, cold call people who are in the right personas or verticals. Although if you do outbound, I usually recommend hiring in at least pairs so that they can compete with each other and then you kind of know who's good or not in that.
But also then, iterating on the process. Because each of them are going to learn different things and learn from each other faster.
But no, that's a great point. Either to control for quality, like maybe one's a lot better than the other one. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they can just learn from each other and hopefully are both great. Mm-hmm. And then you as the founder can be the one who's taking the demo or like taking the meeting and like really understands what's going on for the customer. And then it's more likely that they're going to close. So some people recommend doing it in the opposite direction, but that would be my preference.
I like hiring. So when to make the hire, when you know you can set them up for success, is generally the metric I like to look at. And then I typically like to hire SDRs first. And it's a lot of this, you can hire a sales team first, but I usually SDR, BDR. And the reason I recommend that is if you have a first-time founder who's selling, sometimes they don't know how to manage salespeople, and they don't know how to train the salespeople. And because the BDR, SDR is a more junior hire, there's a little bit more fudge room. And wiggle room. And that person's going to be a little bit more eager to please than someone who has more work experience and they have lower expectations. So, there's a little bit more flexibility in the training that they're going to be giving and figuring things out on how to manage those people.
Makes sense.
Yeah. There's another, optimization you can make on this as a founder, where if you hire someone who's not right out of school, but someone who's like 6 months out of school, and maybe they've been an SDR at a bigger company where they just don't like how much process there is, or maybe they've been in a recruiting agency. Recruiting agencies are great because they're just cold calling people every day, but they're kind of pyramid schemes in some of them. And so you can get someone where they've done a lot of the life learning in their first 6 months. They're just autonomous. They're living on their own. If they have a job they're frustrated in, they've learned a lot, but they also perhaps have lower expectations, especially if you're a first-time founder and don't have a lot of time to manage. And then you can also promise them a faster promotion path if they're doing a great job and kind of like coming up through the ranks. And so that's very attractive to that type of person. So you can probably get someone pretty good as a founder, get a couple of them.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about it, and I know we're all in San Francisco, so it's a little skewed versus maybe somewhere else in the country, but when you're thinking about bringing on, you know, an SDR or first hire, what does compensation look like for folks like that? Especially, you know, let's talk about folks who are maybe fresh out of school or 6 months into their first job, positions like that.
Whitney, you probably have more data than I do.
I mean, SDRs I see all over the place to start. It depends on the numbers that you need too. Mm-hmm. So ideally you've built out some type of business model when you raised money, and you could make that hire before or after you raise money. And then how much you pay is really dependent on the location. You can look up most of that information on AngelList these days to get what the comp looks like. And you need to make sure you have margin for that. But if you look at your numbers and your projections, you need to look back into how many you pull together your funnel and run your metrics on, like, how many top of the funnel do I need? How many leads do I need? How many of those to convert? How many demos do I need? How many of those demos are converting to pipeline, et cetera. So if you run those numbers down, you need to see how much you can manage personally, as well as top of the funnel, and see how many leads the SDR actually needs to fill the funnel for you to make sure you're hitting your metrics or your numbers. So it really is dependent on your individual organization as far as what they're going to be hitting, and then the comp is dependent on where you're based, and you need to make sure those financially can work. If you're a heavy transactional sale, the compensation is going to be very different if you're an SDR for a heavy enterprise sale. And the number of leads they have to generate is very different. So it really is dependent on your individual business and your metrics.
So. When you talk about that, are you thinking about inbound and outbound as being kind of separate as well? Or?
They can be. In the early days, I don't really separate them, candidly. Ideally, the CEO is taking the inbound leads, and the SDR is really managing the outbound, unless you're having them doing the scheduling and things like that. But inbound, they should just be setting up a meeting because it's a warm lead that's coming through, unless you're doing some heavy qualifying on it for big enterprise deals. And in the early days, inbound's a little bit harder to generate too for a lot of companies, depending on the model. If it's a SMB type model or bottoms up type model, there's a lot more leads coming through. And so filtering those mix is more important. So yeah, again, it depends on the business model.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, if you, for instance, some startups will invest in content or get lucky enough to have some PR or something like that, might generate some interest, then the SDR is really going to be more qualifying and appointment setting. Mm-hmm. And then if they're doing more of the cold outbound type of thing, it really becomes a math game where you need to do the math around it. And every founder that's starting a company and looking at this, everyone arrives at the same math, which is like, how much does it cost, you know, to like book a meeting? And then what's my disco to opportunity rate? And then the drop off between opportunity stages. And then like, how much money do I get at the end of that? And then renewal rates later, and then like what is the percent that we're spending on sales and marketing over, you know, how much money we're getting overall. And, you know, so people talk about the payback period. And and that math always makes sense. There's usually a drop off when it goes from like the founder to the people you're hiring in terms of the payback period. So you might get good at it as a founder and you're like, this works, this is great. And then you hire a couple people, but then it turns out their discovery calls aren't quite as good as yours were. Or when they cold call someone, their messaging isn't quite as good. So Whitney, I think you were talking about making sure you like write everything down, script it all.
Yep.
Because anything, any little piece of grain in of sand in that machine that makes it go slower, like really affects your overall numbers. And so there are lots of cautionary tales around it worked even at like two salespeople or four salespeople. And then we're like, great, let's go from 4 to 40. And then it becomes an entirely different game. So 0 to 1 is certainly the most important, but it is important even going from 0 to 1 to make sure you're setting yourself up for success in like the next stage of it.
Yeah, because as you build out a larger team, your market expands. And so the scripts and the conversations, the benefits, the case studies, benefit statements, the case studies, all of that starts to expand with the team. And if you don't have someone working on building that out, there's huge gaps that end up happening. And that's where people start missing numbers.
Yeah, it's also why it's so important to focus early on. And ideally you want to get 10 customers, all of whom look exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore nothing needs to be changed in the conversations. They have the same job titles. They have the same problems. They actually all know the other companies. And so after you get the first two, the third one's like, well, I got the other two. And then after you get to like 6 of them, the last 4 are like, well, I guess we got to do this now.
Yep.
So, sounds like a good way to do it. One thing you mentioned just now, which was really interesting, is the difference between the CEO doing the sale versus the first SDR and trying to diagnose, you know, something, whether it's went off script or wasn't the right person. How do you really start to understand that delta, where sometimes it could just be, for example, the customer reacts differently to the CEO or a founder contacting them or being in the conversation with them versus someone who, when they see on LinkedIn, is a salesperson or an SDR or a BD person or something like that. Have you seen that? Do you see that delta? How do you measure it?
Yeah, I see it all the time, but you can speak to it because you've done this as a CEO.
When I was doing like early calls, it was interesting because I would just start to not tell people who I was at the company. Like I just say, hey, I'm Russ from DocSend, and then they would never look me up or whatever, so they wouldn't know what position I had. But at a certain point, I became comfortable that it didn't actually matter what position I had in the company to be able to sell them. There's also a flip side of this where sometimes if you say you're the CEO and it's an early company, that gives your prospect less confidence in how big you are as a company and causes them to be like, why on earth is the CEO calling me?
Right.
And
right.
So it can kind of go both ways.
Yeah.
But you know, if you're the founder and working in early sales, try to control for that. And then, you know, make sure that, yeah, it can be someone who's in sales calling them. Their need is so great and your messaging is so good that they're actually willing to take that meeting because you really solve something for them and they can't afford not to learn a little bit more about it. In terms of like how to debug the scripts, it just comes down to training, onboarding, spending time with them. Mm-hmm. You can't hire a couple SDRs and just assume they're going to figure it out. It takes a lot of hand-holding early on, and I don't think anything can really substitute for that.
Yeah, especially when you're still figuring it out. With the first hires you bring on board, they're some of the most critical hires. I see a lot of people, there's a lot of attrition in the early days, making the wrong hire. And you have to pay attention to that from the early days and what makes someone successful in their particular role. We talked a little bit about the business models piece, but you were talking a little bit about the sales, what was it again? Sorry, the question. Sorry,
when you have the CEO doing the sale, it's very different for the customer versus an SDR contacting them.
Yep.
And in some cases, maybe it's better if it's an SDR, and in some cases, it's better if it's a CEO. How do you kind of measure that when you're trying to compare how your first SDRs are doing versus how your CEO is doing or is still doing if they're still involved in sales?
So I've had some CEOs that I've worked with who have actually hacked it and set up fake SDR profiles on LinkedIn and set fake email addresses, and they use those to email and then introduce themselves.
Interesting.
So it all goes to their own email when they didn't have the money to hire
an
SDR. So that was one hack I saw in the early days for founders who didn't want to be doing the selling themselves. It's dishonest, but it is a workaround if that's a concern.
Wait, it's the CEO setting up SDR profiles?
They just set up a fake SDR profile on LinkedIn as them and then created an email address that matched it. So there was a person in existence, gotcha. And then would email from that person's email address and then also automatically forwarded to themselves.
That mitigates the risk of them being like, why is the CEO contacting
me? You can also do the flip side of it too, where you create fake CEO emails and then the SDRs can use them if like they don't get a response right away or if deals stall or stuff like that. So,
and you can see how your industry responds to that.
The black magic, the black arts of sales here. This is great.
Yeah, I do think it's important to think about it from the perspective of that first sales hire. If you get brought into a startup, and you just need to ask for a lot of help too, because there's just a lot of variation in terms of if you're an early sales hire at a company, especially like the first few, the company has a lot riding on your success. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't succeed, the company's not sure, like, is it just that sales doesn't work here or was it the wrong people? Mm-hmm. So everyone's very motivated to help you out. So if you come into an early sales role, make sure you meet everyone in the company and just try to absorb as much knowledge as you can. But just remember, everyone's very invested in your success there.
100%.
And so sometimes I see people who don't ask for questions as often as they should. So that's another piece of advice.
On that note, it's really interesting, especially with junior people. Sometimes they're afraid of making mistakes a lot. And they don't realize that as founders, one of your jobs is to make mistakes and mess up on a regular basis. And those mistakes are where all the learning happens. And so if you're not making mistakes and messing up on a daily basis and small, like positioning something differently or learning how to write a different email or trying to find someone on Quora or Twitter and just trying different things. And maybe sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that process is really important and trying those things out and iterating and innovating. Because sales is just as much an innovation process as a product is. And so that junior person has that opportunity to do that. And if you work with your CEO and bring those things to the table, it can actually be really beneficial for you. And don't be afraid of messing up because it's just trying something.
Yeah. So let's switch to some stories. Let's talk about some times. we'll do positive ones first, right? Tell me about like the sale you remember in your mind that you closed. That was like a big success that still stands out as like a great feeling. If you have one that comes to mind quickly.
Long time.
Yeah, there are a couple different types of success for Dachshund that we found. One has been just on like the product market fit as we've iterated on the product, mm-hmm. and as we like changed plans and pricing and just how we package things. Like you can just see in our conversion numbers, things just go up. We had another big success just hiring an SMB sales team. So a lot of our customers are self-serve, but it's phenomenal when they just get called by someone who's being helpful. Like how. Like much better they do, how much more they spend, and like how profitable that was for us as a company. With big deals, I remember one time I showed up to prospect, an important one in New York, and sales guy met me there, and I was wearing tennis shoes. The guy was like, "You can't do that." It's like, "This is in New York City." And I was like, "Oh, it's different?" He's like, "God." We still ended up closing that deal. So
nice.
It was fine.
The product was good enough to make up for the tennis shoes.
Well, luckily they're hidden under the table, like, you know.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it was interesting you talked about like your team and their successes to start, because what immediately came to mind was actually not a deal that I closed, but it was someone who I had hired and just fresh out of college and taught her how to sell. And when she hired her first enterprise deal, she closed her first enterprise deal. And she like sent me a text and was super excited. And it was just like a big celebration. Like it was just... and she had hired her an SDR, and it was a company I had consulted for, and I mentored her. I'm still in touch with her and all that. But I don't remember individual deals. It's been a long time since I sold. I could probably think back on one, but the deals that I actually think of now are the people that I've mentored and taught how to sell, or when they come in and they're like, "Oh my God, I just did this thing," and I'm like, "Yeah, you did." Or someone actually learns how to sell and falls in love with it because it's so fun. When you learn how to do it, it's so much fun when you can get into it. And so especially with engineers, when I see that switch happen, it brings a big smile to my face every single time.
Do you guys have, either in your company or companies you've worked with, or just things you've seen, favorites around how, people structure and incentivize, the sales team, the things that we've seen on television or in movies, right? Like a gong in the sales room when you close a deal, or like the thermometer that you're kind of filling up over time, or the meter, the gauge that you're filling up over time, things like that, that you've seen work really well or that are creative or innovative?
I've definitely seen bells. I've definitely seen the things filling up over time. We had leaderboards in old companies where deals would go up, but it was also really good information in it too, because it was an international team. So you'd see one account get closed here, it'd be like, and there was competitions between teams in different regions. And so they get an account in the US, and then someone in Europe would go after that account. So it was lead gen at the same time as competition, at the same time as like everyone trying to hit their goal number. We had dog fights. That was really fun. It was just against teams, and then individual salespeople would go head to head. So that was like,
that's awesome.
It was really fun. That was definitely enjoyable. And then, cause it plays to the natural competition, but it's very friendly.
Was there a spiff involved with it as well, or just for pride?
No, it was just for pride. 100% for pride and just fun. But there were definitely teams would go and visit each other's offices on a regular basis too. And so, you would always try and set up a deal closing when the other teams were visiting, when you were into dogfighting with one another. It was just fun and silly and like competitive, and it was playful. So it created a friendly competition going. So that was one that I really liked, on a sales team dynamic where it was a way to play.
Yeah,
with cool. one another.
Do you guys do anything like this, or have you seen anything like this?
Yeah, we've done leaderboards. I like non-monetary spiffs. Those are really fun, where especially if it can involve the person, if they have one significant other or just a friend they bring with them. Mm-hmm. So you just buy like someone a gift card for a nice restaurant in San Francisco. So then they get to pull someone else into that with them and take them to the restaurant. And then it just makes them feel like really good about everything. And as a monetary expense for the company, it's not that meaningful, but it's also not an experience the person would have bought for themselves, which mm-hmm. I think is really powerful in terms of making people feel really good about themselves.
Yeah, awesome.
All right, let's talk about some sadder stories. Let's talk about some rejections. Do you have any that you remember that it's still kind of like a scar in your heart or in your memory?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the market and how competitive the deal is, or you know, there are just so many factors. I think probably the ones that are good learning experiences but hard are when you lose a deal, but it's just because you failed to create a sense of urgency there. Or sometimes, especially as you go into larger and larger companies, they look great on the outside in many ways, but many of them are pretty disorganized on the inside. And so, especially if you're doing an account-based sale, there's so much risk in terms of getting the various departments to buy into whatever you're selling to them. And sometimes there's just organizational risk. So you lose your champion like near the end of the deal. And that's just like such a sad moment because you've invested so much in it and there's not a lot you can do. So we always talk about multi-threading and larger deals and to be paranoid all the way up until it closes. Like, you know, until the signature is done, you know, be very paranoid. And so, yeah, some of those they're just tough breaks and our team gets sad, but I think there is some of that that's just inevitable, especially as you go up market, into larger and larger deals.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that. Bill Epsevic from New Relic has a really great story, which if you ever have him, and he's an amazing speaker, by the way, so I'd highly recommend him and I will introduce you. But I was just thinking about, I can definitely remember painful deals that I've lost. And when you were talking about that, someone leaving the organization, I had someone where it was an enterprise deal and there were multiple stakeholders involved in the buying process. And the contact, and every salesperson has had this story before, but the contact I was working with had consistently assured me that they controlled budget. And it was a VP of marketing at the time. And we were working, and it wasn't a huge deal. It was like a $250,000 deal, but it was a significant deal. Like it was going to make my quota for the quarter. And, we brought in the CRO and my VP of sales was with me at the time. And the CRO just like ripped us a new one. He was just a jerk. It was insulting. I think he even wrote a blog post afterwards on all the things we did wrong in the process. Oh, no. It was so painful.
It's the public shaming.
It was total public shaming. And the person I had been working with, she was so apologetic about the whole thing. But it was because there are a couple mistakes, and I can kind of share common mistakes in sales.
Yeah, absolutely.
One, I trusted the word of the buyer that they had decision-making power when there was still someone else who needed to be involved. Two, I didn't start from scratch when there was a new person involved. And every single time there's a new person that gets involved in a sales cycle, you really have to start from the beginning again. And I didn't re-qualify the account. So that was mistake number two. Because I hadn't qualified the account, the value proposition to that buyer who was more senior within the organization was very different from the person I had been speaking with. So I was selling them on something that was a benefit to this level of the person in the org instead of the person at this level in the org. And so what ended up happening, we had the solution for him, but we were speaking the wrong language to the buyer based mm-hmm. on the level they were at. And so the benefit statements we had and the case studies we were citing weren't relevant for him. And it was just like, oh, it was just really painful. Cause like I read that the blog, I think I read the blog or someone sent me it afterwards. And I was like, oh man, we had all these things. Yeah. I knew exactly what I could have done. And it was just laziness on my part. It was just not, trying to cut corners. But yeah, I remember that one.
They stick with you, right?
Yeah, they do. They do. But I learned those lessons, and now I teach them.
yeah, it's great. Well, that also highlights the difference between a transactional sale and account-based sale,
yep.
where the different personas involved each require an entirely different sales cycle. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you're speaking multiple languages just to get one deal done.
Yeah.
And as soon as you pair the wrong messaging with the wrong persona.
Yep.
Yeah. We definitely have those examples too, where they, you know, especially starting out like as an SDR, you call someone and you get something wrong about their job function, like that's done. And they probably aren't going to respond to your emails either. Cause they're like, you don't even know who I am and what I do.
And it's so much more complex these days than it used to be because everyone's titles are all over the place. They don't align with responsibilities anymore. So you really have to understand exactly what each individual person's title is like means within that organization. It's really complex now.
Yeah, we've done some research just with docs and data because it gets used in so many account-based sales by sales teams. Yeah. And just the number of people involved in each buying cycle is just going up over time. So this, I think from a company perspective, is probably not good. It's requiring more decision by consensus or decision mm-hmm. by committee. But as the salesperson, just knowing that there are like five or six people involved in getting the deal done, you're kind of like, uh-oh. But like, you really got to take it seriously. And it's got to be enough money. It's going to be worth your time. Because it's if you're not going to really go through it thoroughly, that's why engineers can make great salespeople, because you're writing code. You can't, there's a mistake, it just won't work. So you got to get it perfect. And same in a larger sale. Like you have to do every single step. And if you're not going to do every single step and you're not going to lose the deal, it's so painful because you've invested so much time.
Yeah. There's the hack of making sure you understand who those buyers, like once you've gone through it a couple times and you have your base customer set, knowing who those buyers are and having a stakeholder meeting where you just tell them every person that needs to be in that meeting. And then mm-hmm. you actually manage it, project manage it basically. And make sure you map it all out for those enterprise deals is so critical. And you have multiple buyers, yeah.
You mentioned some confusion around roles and titles, and that made me think about a practice I've seen where folks are not using the word sales anymore within the organization. Everyone works in partnerships, so there were some other generally vague terms, so that way, if you're a customer, you're never contacted by a salesperson. Do you guys see that more? Do you think that's a good practice? What do you think about that?
I actually haven't seen it that much, at least in our customer base and in the sales teams that we work with. A lot of times they call them the traditional sales roles. It seems like it's more like bottoms up companies or, you know, Atlassian type companies where they want to just be very consultative. And I actually don't know in those instances if they have variable comp or not that are paired with it. But by and large, I've seen people just kind of call them the traditional sales roles.
I've seen earlier stage organizations starting to play with that a little bit, like business analysts or business development. I have started to see it a little bit more. And sometimes people are coming up with titles that are specific to their industry. So it's something more relatable as opposed to a salesperson. So I am seeing it more. As far as an opinion goes about it, I think whatever's going to get you in front of your buyer is what you should be doing, and mm-hmm. You can play around with titles, right? So in the same way, if an SDR is more effective at reaching out to someone or a CEO, great, figure it out. Like figure out which title is most effective. I mean, customer success was coined by Gainsight. They built that entire terminology. And that's why they're the category owner.
It seems like it worked really well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's definitely a possibility to play around with that.
Cool. So we're almost out of time. We're just going to do some quick, short questions here. First thing, what's your favorite sales tool? You know, other than Salesforce, of course, which I doubt either of you would have said. what is your favorite productivity software or tool for sales? And you can't say DocSend either.
I can't say DocSend. Oh,
well, let's take that off the table.
That's a given. But yeah, so we use a bunch of different solutions. Just coming back to the value prop earlier about, especially early on, are you in those calls? And if you can't be in those calls, using call recording. We've used a couple of them. We're using Chorus right now, and it's been great to just, you know, if I can't make a call, I can listen to it later. Mm-hmm. And just to be able to control for all that. And so that's been really impactful for us. Another one is just lean data with routing, especially if you're more of an inbound business or higher volume business. There's that one and other ones that allow you to do efficient routing so you can actually just make sense of everything and prioritize things because you lose a lot of time there otherwise.
That's awesome. I wasn't familiar with that one. I'm going to check it out. It's one everyone knows and uses at this point, I hope, but Calendly has been like a game changer for me just in managing my own personal calendar. Instead of having to go back and forth to calendar meetings. What are some other ones that I really like? I mean, it's an old one, but goodie for just checking. And there's a bunch of different tools out here, so I'm going to call out BuiltWith, but there's a bunch of other ones and just checking companies' tech stack. There's a lot of information you can gain about someone's tech stack. You can tell if they're an early adopter. You can tell what kind of tech they spend money on. You can see, you know, how complex their site is. Like, there's a bunch of stuff you can get from people's tech stack. So any one of the tools that plugs in, but I use BuiltWith because I've had it forever. It's just in my Chrome. That's one I really like. Google has, I mean, this is another silly thing, and I'm talking about Google, not a sales tool, but Google has the autocomplete on sentences for typing that you can just turn on. That's amazing. That saved me a ton of time, and just typing stuff, and they have the like auto reminders. And then in the VC ecosystem, I'm a huge fan of Affinity. That's our CRM internally, and it has this great tool where you can actually plug it into, your browser, and it'll show the connections that you're connected to. So for our portfolio companies, if they see that we're connected to someone, we have a template for them to request an intro, and they can just send the partner, they can see the partner that has, or principal or a member of our team, who's connected to that person, just request an intro. So it's really great at working your network, from that capacity, like LinkedIn, but on steroids, in a lot of ways.
Cool. What is the best or your favorite media that you've ever experienced about sales? So like a movie, TV show, a book, a song, anything like that. I don't know any sales songs, but I thought I'd throw it out there in case one of you do.
Oh, man. Yeah, I've not heard a sales song, but...
I have a friend who writes startup songs, so I can probably have him write one.
If we can get a jingle for the operators.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I probably could, actually.
The sales jingle.
Yeah. So podcast, I wouldn't necessarily call it a sales podcast, but it's a podcast called The Knowledge Project by Shane Parrish. And it's about, he studies a lot of mental models. And there's a particular one I love from a professional poker player. And it's about a culture of optimization. It's something we really strive for internally within our company is how can we always be looking at, take accountability for what's in our control. And let go of the things that aren't in our control, and then looking at ways to learn from the things that didn't work out the way we expected. And so that particular podcast I absolutely love. But and then that episode is I think great for having a strong sales mentality, because if you're paying attention to optimizing your personal sales script, and I say script, but the words matter, but it's not necessarily word for word. But you do need to understand the nuances of how to speak to each individual type of customer. And that mindset is really important for developing that. I also like Daniel Pink's book, To Sell as Human. It really takes a lot of the information and the emotional hangups that people have around sales and gets rid of it, and humanizes it, really, and has a bunch of research and data around concepts around selling and basically how they're wrong. So it's a great book.
That's good. That's cool.
Yeah, some of the ones I like the most, just book-wise, are on behavioral psychology. just because, especially as you get into larger deals or even partnerships, just understanding, I just think how somehow people respond in general, like reciprocity mm-hmm. or authority, even stuff like Thinking Fast and Slow is like a great mm-hmm. book, mm-hmm. or Cialdini, what's his?
Influence.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, there's some really good books just around that, yeah. which I think are good general underpinnings for the more specific and tactical advice you can find in a lot of the sales podcasts and blogs around.
Yeah, awesome. I was going to say, one book I really love for negotiations if you're doing a complex enterprise sale is Bargaining Advantage. So it teaches you a lot of the concepts. Negotiations can be ridiculously fun when you understand how to do it well. And the tactics and things like that, and nuances to negotiating. And that was one of the first books I read around negotiation that broke it down in a very interesting, fun way, where I could tell what was going on the other side of the table when I talked to someone, and I loved it.
Yeah. These are some great resources. All right. If you listen to this episode, you're probably like ready to be an expert on sales. You have the roadmap in front of you.
90% there, yeah.
Just a little bit of practice needed, maybe.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Russ and Whitney, thank you for joining us. It's been great having you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us out there. This has been The Operators with Russ Hedelston and Whitney Sales talking about sales. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil.
Thank you.
Bye.